Welcome to the Real World Theology Podcast, episode 26. It's our 1 year anniversary. That's right. We've been doing this podcast for 1 year. Well, I've been doing this podcast for 1 year. Hopefully you've been listening for 1 year. We've had a lot of great guests on, and we're going to continue that trend. But I want to let you guys know about some of the things that are kind of coming down the pipe with the 1 year anniversary. I'm hoping to have the website revamped a little bit. I've got a really awesome guy helping me work on that right now. So hopefully you'll see some new designs, some new just web interface stuff that looks a little more awesome. This summer, I know lots of you guys have wanted me to put out this podcast more than once a month, or more than twice a month, and I want to do that as well. It's really difficult, but the summer seems like the perfect time, along with our 1 year anniversary of doing this podcast. I'm going to be doing 3 podcasts a month somehow. Somehow I'm going to fit that into the schedule, so look for that, not just twice a month, but 3 times. I don't know how many times I can say that. So 3 times a month for June, July, and August. But that leads me to the first in the summer series, the technical summer series, which is hopefully going to be one of the biggest movies that we have seen or we will see this summer. So it's only fitting that it is the anniversary episode. So X-Men Days of Future Past is the movie we all went to see. And when I say we, I mean 3 awesome guests. That's right, I had a super panel for this one. 2 of them were the gentlemen who were on the very first episode, Mark Wingerder and Griffin Kale. So they joined me here. And the other gentleman who helped me start, made me interested in doing film and theology in the first place, indirectly. So, as he usually says, I'm sorry, you know, for getting me into this if you don't like the podcast. But why would you be listening if you don't like it? So that's James Harleman, all the way from Seattle. The funny thing is, he was getting ready to leave for vacation, so it's super awesome that he took the time to join us. And even though he did leave a little bit before the podcast ended, he did drop some knowledge on us like he is wont to do in his various mediums. So we talk X-Men themes from past movies, from present movies, and from what we might see in the future. It's really, really good stuff. We also just talk about the fact that this podcast is, you know, a year old and how much fun we've had doing it. So here it is, episode 26, X-Men and Days of Future Milestones. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
So, one large meal and then copious amounts of, other stuff. Never mind. There might be Baptists listening to this somewhere.
Alcohol. Large amounts of not alcohol is what he said.
Oh, no.
There you go.
Well, they're going to have to deal with it. If people are listening for the first time, maybe I understand, but I think we've talked about consuming alcohol on the show.
I went to lunch with people from church this afternoon, and one of those people high up in the church said, "Hey, I'll buy your first."
Nice.
So that's just how this works.
The right church.
That's what we call fellowship.
That's what we call fellowship and friends right there.
Well, no, I remember very distinctly. Actually, I was just telling somebody about this because we were with Laura's family at the beach, and they were like, "Hey, how did you get into this whole film and theology thing?" And I was like, "Ah." So I started listening to these reviews and reading these reviews by this guy named James Harlow in Seattle, and it was really weird. We went out there. I just emailed him out of the blue, went out there, met him, and it was this whole thing that you have to do. Like, someone's coming from across the country. We're going to meet each other. What's it going to be like? And so we watch this movie. We go out afterwards. It's kind of like, we're going to have a beer or a coffee. What do you guys do? And we're just like, oh, we're all cool with this. Okay, so we're all on the same page.
Yeah.
that was probably...
So you don't mind alcohol is what you're saying.
Yes,
what I'm saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So the coolest thing about this is that the first episode of Real World Theology came out 1 year ago, more or less today.
Woo!
So 1 year.
Boom.
And I thought it only fitting that the two people that were on the first episode, Mark and Griffin,
yes,
combine with a guy that was probably one of my biggest influences in doing it in the first place, Mr. Harlem Man.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Listeners.
Thanks, man. It's been a busy year for me trying to, you know, do this every week.
Keep up with this guy. Yeah.
So trying to do, and then doing what will probably be one of, I think, the most talked about movies of the year.
Yeah.
Just because, you
know, well, besides Guardians of the Galaxy and Transcendent and.
Not among
the comic people. I think Guardians of the Galaxy is more among the comic fans.
I think people are going to like that movie. But I mean, I think people are going to like that movie.
I'm hoping people like it. I'm talking like
mass interest talking about it. Most talked about of the year. Far more X-Men.
We're going to say X-Men, huh?
Well,
the
I
retcon.
Was, I would say.
Well, the retcon that is X-Men first or X-Men Days of Future Past.
Well, but think I was wondering, like, you know, what kind of money some of these summer movies were going to make this year, and I was really surprised. I think Maleficent is beating out X-Men this week.
Shenanigans.
No, I'm
like,
serious.
This week or like in general?
No, this week.
Oh no, that didn't surprise me.
It didn't surprise me.
I mean, like, there are probably a lot of families who are like, "Oh, we can go see this with our kids," and then they're like, "Crap, why do we go see that with our kids?" Did Angelina Jolie just take her top off? I don't know if that's okay.
Yeah, so many different demographics we've got that might go see Maleficent versus X-Men. Yeah.
Well, we went to go see it on Saturday, Maleficent, that is, and there were lots of people who brought their very, very young children to see it.
I think a lot of people are thinking like, oh, this is like the Wicked of the Sleeping Beauty universe. Or,
I mean, it kind of is, but
it's no spoilers. Good. I mean, is it any? I mean, how is it Lord of the Rings level of darkness and severity?
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, not the movie.
Would you say?
Wait, did you see it?
No, I didn't see it. Do you think a 10-year-old could see that movie and
freaked out? I think a 10-year-old could see that movie and be fine. It wasn't near as dark as the
The trailer made it seem.
The trailer, yeah, the trailer. It wasn't near that dark. So it wasn't that bad. But I mean, I wouldn't take like a 5-year-old to see it.
I mean, I understand that. Yeah, I mean,
You could. It was like a slightly less intense Snow White and the Huntsman kind of thing. You know, it's like it kind of there were scary creatures. Mm. You know, that if you have really small children, I imagine they could give your kids nightmares. Even though those creatures always fall on the side that your kid would hopefully be rooting for.
Yeah,
based on the way the story pans out, but they were still, you know.
Oh, are you rooting for her at the end?
I'm not telling you.
God, I hope you're rooting for her. I kind of want to see it now.
Yeah, no spoilers.
No, it was better than I thought it would be, but still had a lot of problems.
So you did have some problems. You said.
What's your
letter rating?
Okay, wait. My letter. See, I switched to stars because.
What's your star rating?
which movie are we reviewing? Wait.
Yeah, I know. So I thought Maleficent was about a 3.5.
3.5. That's not bad though.
No, it wasn't. It was
out of 5, right?
Yeah,
not out of 10.
No, yeah. we're actually gonna do Maleficent on the podcast next episode.
Okay.
So you can all listen to that one. I'll give you my whole thing. But this one, I know I don't want to hold James too long because I'm basically preventing James from going on unplugged vacation.
He's on his way to not being on the phone vacation.
That's awesome.
So I really appreciate you making
your last contact with the outside world.
Yeah, I feel privileged.
If you die, I'm going to feel like privileged that I was the last person to like talk to you.
That's it.
Wow, this is really morbid.
It's just me. I'm heading up to Alaska. I'm going to have a radio. We're going to just, you know, hang out in the woods. And never mind.
He's not
going to die in a bus.
Yeah. No, I was referencing The Wolverine, which is Chris DeBrett.
The Wolverine.
You
know,
our lead in to our feature, right?
And there we go. Look at that segue.
See, segue into X-Men Days of Future Past. So we've all seen it, and I can't wait to find out what you guys actually thought about it. But I guess if you're listening and you thought we were going to be reviewing Maleficent, I'm sorry.
Yes.
The episode will have something to do with X-Men, so you should have known.
Podcast. No, wait. I didn't.
So
you apparently have fans.
I was saying British fans. Yeah. We're the British fans that you have.
Well, we've already established ourselves as Anglophiles in multiple arenas, so I assume that all our fans are British.
Right. Oh, okay.
Or at least they should be.
Yes.
But so like I said, if you're listening to this, you're expecting Days of Future Past. You're going to get Days of Future Past. If you're not and you're still listening, I'm not really sure why, but we're going to spoil the movie for you.
A lot.
And spoil I have a lot to go into the other X-Men movies if you haven't seen those.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all that too. So if you haven't seen the universe, well, you don't need to see half of it anyways.
Well, I guess you've already signed up for it. And so if you don't know, X-Men Days of Future Past is about the X-Men sending Wolverine into the past in a desperate effort to change history and prevent some event that will create Sentinels, and then Sentinels will hunt mutants and humans, and the world will be pretty bad. So,
all right.
How did everyone like this movie? And when I say how did everyone like this movie, I mean, James, how did you like this movie?
Well, it has the James seal of approval. I am not as harsh on some of the X films, so honestly, we might differ a little bit. I mean, I think this was a nice end to the Wolverine series, and a lead in to now some X Men movies. I think really is what's happening, and I don't say that as if I have a problem with that. I think if you take the series as a whole and look at it solely from the development of Wolverine, we've basically seen somebody come from a character who is who has no identity and is basically a beast in a cage, now all the way come full circle to now being, he's been discipled and now he's a discipler. And in fact, in a little bit of a weird twist, right, he's discipling his mentor. So you kind of come full circle with the Terminator twist. I mean, robots are going to destroy everything in the future. there's a lot of very obvious. That seems to be the fear of technology. If you notice Winter Soldier, we've got the algorithm for machines that are going to wipe out a bunch of people. Here we have Sentinels. There's sort of a recurring hearkening back to Terminator theme, I think, going on in several films this year. Even Transcendence, fear of technology. So I just... we've got this sphere of technology theme. We're taking a character that's now sort of become the teacher after a long series that some love. I mean, we all hate Origins, right?
Oh, yeah, the movie?
Yeah, it's a bad movie. Yeah.
I just kind of blocked that it happened. That's why it took me a second.
Is that the one with Deadpool in it?
No, it was the one with Gambit.
No.
Oh, Gambit was in it. Oh, gotcha. Yeah, loved it. Loved it. 5-star review from me. The Griffin seal of approval.
No.
Man, that was a good one.
That's when you got kicked off the podcast.
That's when you send the broadcast thing across. We are now pausing for station identification. Like, we were in technical difficulties.
I'm really super entertained by like 2/3 of Origins, but then it just all falls apart. So.
But I mean, he liked Tomb Raider. So.
I think the shortest answer, just to sum it up, is I think they took the best parts from the X-Men trilogy and they take from the early X-Men films, and of course now the thrust of First Class, and really Bryan Singer's back on his game, blended both of them together, mm-hmm. and pulled kind of a Star Trek with the alternate timeline reboot to give us now that, you know, now it's open for anything. I had a couple quibbles with how Magneto can magically control Sentinels by turning metal liquid and some other strange things, but you know, except for a couple of wonky science issues, which of course mm-hmm. have not been present in any of the other X-Men films or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, except for those things, you know, it was thoroughly entertaining. I thought it had a great emotional arc. It choked me up a couple times, so I'm sold.
So, like, compared to all the other things, and that we're not in the complete Marvel anything, we're not talking about Spider-Man, we're not talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, just in what Fox is doing with the X-Men films, like, this is kind of the peak of where they're at, right?
I think that, well, I was a big fan of The Wolverine, so, and it's mm-hmm. such a different film. James Mangold mm-hmm. giving us kind of more of a Clint Eastwood man walking into situation film with a little, I mean, there was carryover and him dealing with his guilt, but it was very much just kind of, you know, the stranger walks in to Japan and has an amazing adventure. I loved the way that played out, so I did enjoy that film. Very, very different film, kind of apples and oranges, but yeah, I mean, I think that they're going up. I mean, like, certainly it's like they're ascending a ladder and okay. First Class, yeah. So but the only real problem I have was Origins. I think if you sit down and watch the original trilogy back to back, I think there's as many flaws in one as there is in three. I think most mm-hmm. of the problems people have with three are because they have some knowledge via comic or cartoon with the way, I think their problems are outside the movie with characters they love being killed early or with storylines not playing out the way they wanted them to. I don't know that you're actually judging the movie itself, which I think Ratner bent his style to match Singer's. And, I mean, it's the same actors. The acting's not significantly better or worse. So I don't know. I haven't felt like the trilogy plunged as far as people thought until Origins, and now I think it's back on its game.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. I actually had so many people talking about how bad The Last Stand was that I actually went back and watched X-Men, X-Men 2, or X2, and then The Last Stand all in a row on the same night. And I was like, you know, it wasn't my favorite of the three, but outside of the comic issues, it was... I mean, it was bad, but it wasn't like...
Yeah. I mean, think about it
for a moment. Think about how it mirrors the Star Wars trilogy. First one breaks ground, but, you know, doesn't hold up as maybe visually as well as then the second one blows everything out of the water, just like The Empire Strikes Back. And then third one, Return of the Jedi, X-Men Last Stand, both flawed. And hey, no Ewoks, so there's a plus. I think in many ways the first trilogy gets... I think we have a bad taste in our mouth from a lot of peripheral aspects and not the movie themselves.
And I come at it from the perspective of like, and I had a little bit of this discussion talking about the Wolverine, and people tend to kind of harp on the problems of the movie more than they actually... Well, were you entertained? Did you enjoy the movie? I mean, we could argue about it being a, you know, good film, the Wolverine, or X-Men Origins. Obviously, that's a lot harder to argue as being an entertaining film. There's no way you can make it out to be a good film. The Last Stand was not really particularly a good movie, but I super enjoyed it, and I always loved being in the universe. X2 is a good movie. X-Men is a good movie. It just doesn't hold up as well since we've come so far in filmmaking ways and storytelling and then broadening of universes and stuff. And I loved The Wolverine. I thought it was a great movie. So this one is a good movie. I mean, it's a really good...
You're talking about Future Past.
Yeah, this one. The Days of Future Past is a good movie, and it's I always enjoy seeing now that we're trying to... Every movie production company is trying to put as many superheroes as they can in one movie to be like, you know, the Avengers. It was done, you know, perfectly with the Avengers. So to see it done well, like it was with Days of Future Past, is just, how can you not enjoy that? And of course, you know, we can talk about the nuances of, you know, this was kind of botched and this idea didn't work, but this one did. I mean, ultimately... Did I enjoy it? It's a great movie. Yes, I enjoyed it a lot.
Cool.
I had a blast.
So James is a thumbs up. Marks is a thumbs up. Mm-hmm. Griffin?
Thumbs up. I mean, I loved First Class, and there were a lot of people that kind of had issues with it, but I thought from top to bottom, I really enjoyed First Class.
Right,
so
I totally skipped over First Class. Yeah,
So coming into this, I was like, I was so glad to see Bryan Singer take what he had done with the original X-Men trilogy and translate it with this new X-Men First Class, and then to say... And this is kind of jumping a little bit ahead, but for the next film, he's going to take the First Class characters and use them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I love that he's saying, like, I already did this one thing. Let me use these new toys and play in this new kind of universe. And I really enjoy the fact that he has kind of taken an opportunity to at the end kind of retcon some things and leave himself room to kind of create whatever he wants, and that it doesn't have to kind of conform to the comics, because he, in a way, did that with some of the stuff in the original work that he did.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just kind of take himself and say, okay, well, we're going to go to this new place and see what kind of new ground we can break into this movie universe. Let's do that. And so I really love the movie. I thought my favorite part about it was the fact that it was darker. It kind of was heading in that direction, but it didn't dive into it head deep like the way that Superman tried or Man of Steel tried to.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't like just jump in like all the way and say we're going to be super dark with this movie. It was more like it's going to have some dark parts, but then there's like a lot of lightness and lightheartedness to it. And I think having Wolverine in a movie just does that. I mean, having Hugh Jackman play like traditional like joking and making jokes Wolverine, it just works really well. So I really liked it. Thumbs up all around. Yeah, very happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also really, really enjoyed it. And I think one of the reasons I really did enjoy it was because of what I think a couple of you have already hit on with that Wolverine character arc, mm-hmm. almost coming, not really coming to a conclusion, but having something different than we've seen before. I actually listened to a couple of people talk about how the Wolverine in the movies is a really different Wolverine than you typically see in the comics. The Wolverine in the comics basically is always a loner. He's always kind of like angry, doesn't really want to be on a team, almost reluctantly is on a team.
Pushes people away.
Yeah, pushes people away. And this one, we've seen a full transformation, kind of from the from the original X-Men movies, following the Wolverine, and now into this movie, we see him go from, I think, like James said, from kind of discipled to discipler. You know, he's changed that role, and it was a really refreshing, just vision to see.
Yeah.
I feel like he wasn't boring anymore.
Yeah, and this one, you know, this is the first X-Men movie that all the X-Men movies have dealt with the theme of, like, the outcast and being different and how the world treats you being different from the norm, quote-unquote, and all the different ways that the mutants try to combat that or try to embrace that and kind of heal the relationship between human and mutant. This one kind of takes it to the extreme. We finally see, like, how this kind of movie universe projects what could come of, like, the world treating mutants differently, and that's, we have this apocalyptic world where mutants are just being hunted down and killed. You know, so now we've got this whole, like, we've taken it to this really dark level, and it was interesting to see how that, you know, they kind of played with that to take it to that level and unify everybody, kind of going back to an X2 type of thing where the, you know, the evil mutants and the good mutants, quote-unquote, however many shades of gray are there, had to come together and work together. So it was, you know, I was kind of like, you know, a little bit fatigued by that theme, a little bit, just seeing it in this movie again. But it's just part of the nature of the X-Men. You have mutants, they're different than humans, and they're just going to be treated differently than humans. And really, the only movie that didn't do that was the Wolverine. So with this one, it was like, okay, so we're back to this theme, but just, I don't know, I felt taking it that extra level, just how the comic did it with this Days of Future Past storyline, was interesting to me, you know.
Yeah, something else, I think, I up here have a lot of friends that often talk. There's a lot of talk. I get to do some work with Emerald City Comic Con, and so in the comic book world, there's a lot of complaining about how female characters only exist in some ways in correspondence to or to fuel the story of the men, which to be fair, even though in some ways I love the emotional arc of what I call the Wolverine series, I mean, even Jean really in the third film personifies the beast that he was, and he kind of, like, he's finally loving someone enough to give it up, and he almost kind of kills the beast that is himself, and there's sort of some symmetry, but ultimately then you see female characters kind of just existing in context around the men. I really liked that Days of Future Past gave us a strong focus on Mystique. She was the object of their pursuit, and yet at the same time, she had her own narrative, her own struggle for that. She became kind of the center of how do I balance vengeance or justice, and really, I felt like Jennifer Lawrence got some space to act, even though she's surrounded by a bunch of other guys, and had as much to do with the story as far as contributing to it, and so I love that it hits on a few more cylinders, even of just including women as real characters.
Mm-hmm.
Did it feel like almost too much pressure to have all that on just Mystique when the entire series has been basically this almost Professor X versus Magneto and their conflicting worldviews?
Well, I think
almost
first
too
class,
much to shift.
Well, I think First Class sets that up, though, in the fact that she's with him and goes over. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Matthew Vaughn ever intended that, but to me, that felt like a natural extension. And so I felt like it worked in that regard. And Wolverine, in many ways, gets reduced. I was surprised how little the focus... I mean, he basically is just the delivery man. He delivers the message, and the story goes to others. And I thought that was bold, and they pulled it off. I mean, he is literally thrown out of the climax. He's thrown away.
He is.
I guess I thought that shift worked, and they used her to sort of juxtapose Charles and Eric in it.
Yeah, I mean,
I felt like it worked.
She becomes in that movie a symbol of their differing worldviews, mm-hmm. and also kind of the product of their differing worldviews. So I think for both Charles and Eric, as young people, they kind of get a glimpse of what their differing worldviews would become in their older selves. And you see in their older selves how the wisdom has kind of taken it to this large extent where they realize, like, that was just, we were stupid and childish. and really just selfish in a lot of ways. Both of them were. And I think that to see them work that out in throughout the entire story, I appreciated that. And I think it'll be interesting to see, in the next movie, how they continue that storyline of them being in existence with each other, but are they going to have a massive, you know, conflict still in the next movie?
Mm-hmm.
Or how does that, what does it look like? Does Magneto even show up in the next movie? I think one of my favorite things too, and this is kind of just a tangent and it really doesn't even require any more conversation about it, but I love that they didn't really waste time explaining little things to you. Like Kitty Pryde having that power to send people back in time. That was a thing in Days of Future Past, but like they didn't really waste time explaining that, which I really appreciated. It's something that didn't need to be explained. There were a lot of things like that where I was like, I'm glad they didn't like waste time doing that. And that's kind of what you said, something about the Magneto situation with him being able to control Sentinels. It's like, yeah, it doesn't really scientifically add up, but like Magneto was he pretty much handles everything in the comics world. Like, he can just, like, do anything. You're like, how does he do... Oh, he's, like, pushing himself away from the metal on the ground. Oh, that makes sense. That's how he can fly.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm sure that makes sense. He's controlling the metal, controlling himself. Yeah, so, okay, I got it.
As long as he's not in his prison, way, way below the Pentagon,
yeah, right.
He can do almost anything.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he can... Yeah.
And, as long as he's not completely surrounded by plastic, because he can't reach through plastic with his powers to get to metal.
He's got a pretty short range. Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I guess we don't really need to talk about that, do we? You said that requires no conversation.
I just didn't feel like it needed a lot of context.
He can't reach through the metal. He can't reach through the plastic to the metal of the Pentagon, but certainly if he's lifting an entire stadium size or larger, apparently the range is okay.
Or like the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah. See, that's the thing about these X-Men movies, and, you know, because we could spend this whole time talking about the timeline and how it's messed up, and, I mean, you know, like, there's been so many articles about it, and then, like, well, how does Kitty Pryde actually have this power? In the comics, how does she just measure it?
It's called secondary mutation. It's already a thing in the comics. I don't know why. There's even tertiary doofs.
Yeah. Come on.
Yes, that's right.
Well, yeah.
Gosh.
There's tertiary mutations.
Yeah.
Well, it's got to be, right? Because I haven't read Days of Future Past.
She has the power in Days of Future Past. That power specifically. And
Kitty Pryde doesn't.
Kitty Pryde does.
She does.
I'm pretty sure.
No,
it's the other girl.
Cyclops and
Jean's daughter,
who doesn't exist because we killed them off in X3.
Hope.
Yeah. That's right. It's Rachel. I think. Anyway,
Rachel.
But here's the thing with the continuity stuff. Everybody complaining about the continuity in the movies. It's like, guys, have you read the comics?
Yeah.
Because the sheer number of horrible retcon. I mean, you look back. They love to blur it now, but like Tony Stark was back, I think, in Korea back in the original stories, and now even if you read the normal comics, they're flashing back to Afghanistan. It's like, well. Okay, wait a minute. Like, they've blurred and retconned so much over the years.
Yeah.
People are complaining about it, saying, oh, you didn't adapt it right. Well, what are you talking about?
That's the thing about these movies. I mean, it's like, you know, how much, you know, disbelief are you, like, not trying to suspend, right? Because you're like, well, I could totally believe a guy can get shot 10 times and be, you know, I'm cool with, like, him being, you know, healing and having claws coming out of his hands. But this whole, like, messed up continuity thing is just killing me. I mean, come on. They're really great popcorn movies, and they're done really well, and they explore really good things, and that's why we're here, you know, talking about this. And I think I wanted to hit before we get too far from the Mystique thing, and you know, putting too much on her and all that thing. Like, I didn't think it was putting too much on her because there were so many other, like, you know, journeys we were going through, especially with more so Charles Xavier than Magneto. You know, I thought. His whole, like, even though it kind of ended too soon, it's like, hey, wake up, you should be okay with this, and he's like, okay, I'm okay with this now. But his whole, like, you know, kind of being down on his luck and his just being paralyzed by fear, I thought was a really good kind of like dual journey we were going on with the whole Mystique thing and her journey to kind of, you know, is she going to not kill somebody or is she going to become the through her destiny and everything like that. So
it's Kitty Pryde that takes the place of Wolverine in the comics. She goes back in time.
Yeah.
Anyways, continue. Right. Sorry. Disregard Griffin. Carrying on.
Griffin's very upset right now because he just...
Frustrated.
He just not comic to something.
I just not comic something. I'm frustrated. Anyways.
Well, I will echo what you're saying, though, about how we are so cynical that we will not... We won't just rest with it. We over-explain things in movies in a large degree. I mean, you think back to Star Wars. Man, what were the Clone Wars? There's so many things.
Midi-chlorians. Can we talk about that
in just
a second? Midi-chlorians. They created an entire... Get out of here.
Nobody say Jar Jar. I just freak out.
Misa, no say Jar Jar.
Stop it.
Sorry.
Stop it.
But you go back to the original Star Wars, they're dropping so many ideas that aren't fleshed out and explained. And that's... There are so many holes in a lot of... I think back in the 80s, you're watching science fiction, there was a fun to referencing things or having things that were left unexplained, because when you come in a subjective experience in life, that's the way it is. Like, friends reference things, people seem to have things, you don't know where they got them. Like, we've sort of lost... I think we lost that in our storytelling. I'm glad to see it back. Yeah, the Magneto thing could bug me, but the Kitty Pryde thing didn't. It's like, years have passed. How do I know what she's picked up? How do I know how this is expanded? Or she was infected with the techno virus, or, you know, who knows? Yeah. Like, people have lives and stories that happened between last time when I saw them.
Well, it's not just about our stories, though. Doesn't it say a lot about our culture? Because now in, like, our information-saturated culture, basically making a movie about something that's already out, whether it's an adaptation or not, we've talked about this on some of the other podcasts, like, whenever you make something and it's not exactly the same, you basically have... the comment section on a forum. That's what everyone's opinions are.
Yeah, right.
It's like, I'm sorry, that's not exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
Let me Wikipedia this for you.
Well, and that's where I think that's where people miss the fact that and I think this is just a common man doesn't understand this concept, but Fox is not Marvel. And they don't have to be. They can do whatever they want. And Bryan Singer does not work for Marvel Comics. He works for Fox Comics or Fox Movies in some form or fashion, and he can do whatever he wants. He can have that written however he pleases, and, you know, he doesn't have to adhere to any previous story because he just straight, like, that's not who's paying him. And so I think that it's more of a joy to see these other writers who are often probably much better at their jobs than some of the comic book creators take this story and rewrite and say, here's this new thing. And I'm not downing on Chris Claremont at all because he did a great job with Days of Future Past. But
good. I was about to accuse you of blasphemy. Go on.
I mean, he did a great job with Days of Future Past. But I think to give Bryan Singer like the wit just to say, hey man, go ahead, like, kind of have fun with it, and it's your baby, and we're hiring you to take this into a few years from now. So we want you to, you know, do what you want. And that's the same thing with Joss, that he had that opportunity just to kind of, like they said, here are these characters, make them whatever you feel like they need to be. And, I mean, Tony Stark was not the funny, happy, like, enjoyable person to watch prior to Iron Man coming out. Like, that just isn't the case. So I think now the comics have taken on this, like, Tony Stark is funny, which he wasn't before. And so I think... there's something great about what's happening in the movies that I appreciate.
Yeah, film is just a totally different medium, and I think, you know, part of me doesn't really understand all of the griping and complaining about differences from, you know, the comic universes, because, you know, now we have a movie universe for Marvel, we have a movie universe for X-Men with Fox, and it's going to be different from the comics just naturally because it's just a different medium. I mean, you really wouldn't be able to watch a Tony Stark that's maybe similar to some of the comic books because he's just not as interesting, or he's just a jerk or whatever. And so I think film gets a chance to kind of put its own spin on comics, and that's, I think people need to embrace that a little bit more. Because it's just as enjoyable. I mean, because I haven't read the comics as much. I've read some, but, you know, I'm separating the universes you know, totally outright, because I'm a fan of the movies and I embrace the movies, and so all this kind of, you know, backstabbing and biting about, you know, well, you liked that, but you know, it's so different from the comic or whatever. I mean, you don't ever look at internet comments. Just don't.
Well, I think that very principle is what we're fighting, because
right.
When I walked out of the theater, mm-hmm. everyone was like, oh, that was so cool. That was so cool. That was so cool. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not until I'm reading things like a day or two later or even a week later of people trying to like justify that this thing happened or that thing happened. And it feels like another one of those scenarios where we have to cater to the loudest, like, I want to say 1%, you know, 1 to 10% of people
right.
who have read the comic that went to see this.
And even the comics world itself is like, you know, retconned and retconned again. I mean, it's like, just like James had mentioned, I mean, it's like the comics don't have their own, you know, kind of set ways that everything should be. They take stories and characters and play with them and change things, and you just kind of accept it. You're either going to immerse yourself in this world or you're not, and you're going to complain about all the little nuances. And it's like, I mean, why not just kick back and enjoy the movie, you know? That's what I do, yeah. and I'm fine with me doing that, you know?
Well, we talked about a little earlier how through the entire X-Men series, there are some themes that you can't get away from.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I mean, I guess if you make Wolverine specifically, you know, you can maybe get away from it a little bit, but, I mean, concepts of dealing with allegories for racism or segregation, you know, harkening back to witch hunts, the McCarthy area, the Red yeah. Scare, you know, trying yeah. to find communists, anything that divides people, like, we can obviously find in this movie. But what I did like is what you were talking about earlier, Mark, when you actually almost shifted from that, took it to the, I mean, you did include that, but you took it to its most logical conclusion, or the logical conclusion that the story was going to. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, you ended up focusing on the characters a lot more.
Yeah.
And so what I was curious is, I think we saw a lot more of what people liked from First Class in this movie. We got to see the development of Professor X before he just became, you know, Jean-Luc Picard in a wheelchair, being like the all-knowing, all-wise, yes. best answer for everything guy. And, you know, we got to see Magneto be more than just a jerk.
Yeah.
And so, like, going to explore that more, how did the journey that we saw Professor X go on in this movie really strike you? Like, what really stood out about that?
Well, I think the fear, was a big theme in this, you know, it's kind of a big theme in the X-Men movies, but particularly this movie, it was like, you know, with the humans, you know, anytime they saw like a mutant do something non-human-ish,
everybody loses their mind.
I should set up these sentinels. Oh. That's my Nixon impersonation. It was really bad. But, you know, they were afraid. And Trask's whole impetus for getting his sentinels made and getting the funding for it was fear. You want to fear these people because, you know, that's it, we can make these pretty robots. But that's what held Charles Xavier back. I mean, was fear. Fear with dealing with his legs not working anymore. You know, giving up his powers and his, basically, I guess, his school and all the people around him, just because he was so afraid of facing what the present was for him at that time. Losing his friend to another journey, parting with Eric and or Magneto, you know, that whole thing. Fear is what really kept him back. So I really enjoyed kind of exploring that and the fact that, you know, we got to see that Charles Xavier is not perfect. He's not this, you know, perfect, cleanly shaven bald head. I want to worship at the shrine of Picard, Professor X. You know, I think it's nice to kind of be able to see that. It kind of reminded me of to go into another universe, Doctor Who. The 11th Doctor, when he regenerates, he gives this whole speech of, we're all different people throughout our lives, but I will always remember, you know, and you have to remember who those people are, but then you become somebody else. And so you're multiple, you're different people throughout your life. And so I think this is a story that gets to view, like, you know, if you think of it in terms of a Doctor Who, this is like you know, the fifth Professor X or something, the third Professor X, you know, versus we're, you know, all the way at the future Professor X. So I really enjoyed kind of seeing that shade of him. And of course, I think, you know, in a movie that is just overloaded with characters and actors and performances, James McAvoy out-acted all of them. Like, no. he was fantastic.
Except for Michael Fassbender. Okay.
I mean, Michael Fassbender, I thought, didn't have as much to do as James McAvoy.
It's because he just made it look easy.
I know he does. But and he does great, and I actually really think that Jennifer Lawrence is amazing as Mystique, and she really kind of, you know, she's doing a lot of action and everything in this movie, but she still kind of has these looks and has these, you know, just moments where she's really acting through all that makeup, and she did a great job. So anyway, I really enjoyed his journey and seeing McAvoy portray that.
I like what you're saying about fear, and I think it's on Xavier's side. We see that fear, and he has to, I mean, you know, not only hope, but then saying that they need to go, you know, telling Mystique they need to go a different path. If we sort of cross the aisle, I think we see both Eric and Mystique wrestling with anger and how to deal with anger, which, I mean, and that's still, and that's been Eric's thing since first class, but. So you almost on the one side you have fear and that need to hope again. That mm-hmm. need, so fear turns to hope, and then that call we see their anger manifesting as vengeance in different forms. Like Mystique wants to try to find some way to split the difference between Charles and Eric, but it's still so she's angry about the death of actual, I mean, friends, angels, mm-hmm. people in first class. So she's acting like she wants very targeted vengeance, but it's still vengeance, and so it. The film grapples, and I don't know that it really got to a sense of resolution, because that's sort of always been. I mean, the whole idea of Xavier being similar to Martin Luther King, Eric, Malcolm X, and just like how the violent versus pacifism, or that idea, you know, Xavier is always saying we've just got to have hope, which usually just winds up being just like the Star Trek motif. Thank you, Patrick Stewart. Kind of that we just have to have hope in human nature that it'll eventually naturally come around. And meanwhile, then Eric's like, no, we need to slaughter a bunch of people and make an example so that they're paralyzed and don't mess with us. I mean, like, so you've got vengeance, and then you've got this desire, you know, and despite all the atrocities, Xavier's always giving mercy. And so, I mean, for me, it really comes down to, you've got Mystique's character, you know, where is that place where we can orbit, like, both of those have their place, which is that the movie is, when we see Xavier realizes his way doesn't, he's too rigid, it doesn't work, the other side doesn't work. We get the sense that now they understand we need to work together. I don't think the film ever gives us a great, okay, but what then would that actually look like? And of course, I'm going to butcher a G.K. Chesterton quote, but he once talked about, you know, how come Christianity can have both the martyr and the crusader, and that the gospel is really this, the gospel is not about harmony and balance, the gospel is the crazy place of tension around which both those things can orbit and actually have truth and meaning. And it, like, there is a place in the gospel where, like, vengeance is meted out, not by human hands, but, like, mm-hmm. vengeance is meted out. And then ultimately, then, obviously, mercy and grace, I mean, the ultimate grace isn't by human hand either. It's by incarnate Son. But you have that tension created to where, like, I understand the hearts of both of those men, and there's only one place to come together.
Well, I'm going to say that's one of the best things about this movie to me is whether I'm already on Professor Xavier's side, mm-hmm. because I'm like, oh, well, this is obviously the, you know, let's all hold hands and get along, and that's what I know I'm supposed to be rooting for, because that's the way less people die. I also understand, especially in this movie, watching that scene with Magneto on the plane,
yeah.
arguing with Xavier, being like, you know, I have lost people and you don't mm. know.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, well, I'm kind of with him too. You know, how much crap do you take
yeah.
before, you know, how many cheeks do you turn when those cheeks are your friends
yeah.
before, you know, you have to punch back.
Right.
And that tension, I think, is real, and that's why The one of the problems we have here, and what I think James just basically explained great, which is why I'm going to say it again, is, you know, when we try to take that, either we try to strike that balance as humans, like, we can't do it.
Yeah.
We need something that's more perfect at doing it.
And it's, you know, I hear one of the things that, one of the imagery, pieces of imagery that I always think of when you talk about the Trinity, is the dance of the Trinity and how this, you know, the God that we believe in has this kind of coexistence type of setup, where there's this triune God that is always kind of orbiting each other and dancing with each other. And it's interesting that when we try to, like you see with Xavier and you see with Magneto, you know, go one way because, like, Xavier's is, he hopes that inhumanity, and that ultimately causes him issues. Magneto has no hope in humanity, and he goes that way. You know, we're going both sides of the aisle, you know, very far right, very far left, or whatever. That's what, you know, causes so many issues, and you kind of see both sides of that. You know, really, it's kind of, I totally get what you're saying as far as, like, there's only kind of one place to be in the middle, and that's really, that's grace, and we don't even have the capacity to do that. And so, you know, you get to see that. That's the thing. Like, I was totally with Magneto's cause. I was totally with Xavier's cause in so many different parts of these movies, respectively, because there's so many shades of gray in all of this. Because it's
how many,
like,
shades of gray?
So many.
Not a number, a specific number. That you should...
not
40. That, we'll just say 49.
More or less than 50.
We'll just say 49. 49 shades of gray.
As we're sort of grappling, maybe I'm just shooting from the hip and maybe I'm totally wrong, but I couldn't reconcile. I just said maybe they didn't hit it. Maybe they hit it in a way I didn't expect, as you were just explaining fear and reminding me of the plane scene, which, by the way, probably one of the greatest acting moments in the film, but just beautiful. But what happens then is what we see, I don't think it gets great definition, but if you kind of look at the ending, Xavier, like, a lot of people die. A lot of people get crushed and shot. Like, Magneto's vision, it has some effect. Xavier calls out and says it's not realized. Like, Xavier's way doesn't get realized because some people die. Eric's way doesn't get realized because he doesn't get to take it to the level he wanted to. And then what we see then is a bunch of people died. Some people get saved. And then Trask, right in the center, she drops the gun and gives him unmerited favor. And so even though it's messy, there's this weird sense of neither side's working, and then there's this odd little act of grace on somebody who definitely doesn't deserve it, and then we're done. Maybe there was a little bit more of a pointed image than I was thinking earlier.
Well, I think in that, it's to talk about, it seems like they, with God and then also with Xavier and Magneto, when you compare the two, really Xavier and Magneto's ideals kind of, they marry, you can't, they, I've never married the two at the same level. Mm-hmm. So, like, even in the old, whenever they're both older, they're both more level-headed at that point. They're neither one of them are on opposite ends of the deal. But in their young age, they kind of represent those two sides of the coin that is still one coin, I think, whenever it comes to God. But I think, as I'm talking about this, I was thinking about this morning, at our church, he taught on Ananias and Sapphira, and the whole idea of, like, they died because they in a way kind of were disobedient and dishonest and this sort of thing. But one of the most interesting things about that was our pastor spoke. He said, he was like, you know, I believe in that moment that they were still both welcomed into the kingdom at the end of that. That death wasn't punishment and then eternal damnation. That death was just death. And in that, there was this moment of, like, here is grace and love in that. And I think that that's where you have such a cool, I think, comparison to what happens in these movies, because it isn't. I think if Mystique had shot Trask, yes, it would have probably still created Sentinels. But that is a moment of, like, justice, and at the same time, a moment of, like, grace in that. That, like, yes, you know what, I forgive you, but I'm still not going to let you do this. Like, it's okay that you want this, but I'm still not gonna let you do it. There's still justice in this moment. So there's some part of me that, like, doesn't think that. I think they marry the two really well and get the point across in X-Men really well. But I think that to try and say that it's an exact replica is really difficult. Because I think there is so much justice in what Magneto sees. And I think at the same time, Xavier, throughout comics and throughout movies, doesn't see the point of justice. In that he sees like that it should happen, but he doesn't actually take steps to make it happen outside of the passive kind of watcher. And I think that's what that moment in the plane is of, like, you just keep walking away. You left us whenever things were getting bad. You went into your house and you locked yourself away with Beast. Well, things were getting bad.
Yeah. Well, Charles at the time says, you know, you took the things that meant the most to me. And, you know, Eric, like, quips back, you know, maybe you should have fought harder for them.
Yeah.
Except he says it way better than I do.
Yeah, right.
You know? And I don't know. I don't necessarily think that I would ever say that Professor Xavier doesn't desire justice.
After all, he is fighting against what he believes is wrongdoing.
Yeah.
That's kind of the whole X-Men premise, is like fighting against Magneto trying to, you know, destroy humans, basically.
I think they have a couple places in the movie, and one of them is when I think Charles is talking to Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, like, the thing that we need most right now is one of the most human things, and that's hope. I think Charles doesn't see mutants as that incredibly different. At the core, they are still human.
Yeah.
They still have human desires. You know, if we got into, like the meta, you know, they would still be something that's created, I assume, in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so they're still going to have, you know... desires, they're still going to have longings, you know, they're still going to have empty places that they need filled, and they're going to try to fill that in whatever way that humans try to fill it, usually in incorrect ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Xavier wants justice for everyone. Magneto just wants justice for his kind.
Yeah.
Or what he's, you know, relegating off as his kind, which is why you get, I think, the Martin Luther King versus the Malcolm X thing again.
Yeah, we always get way closer to Magneto's vision than we ever do to Charles Xavier's vision. And that's kind of one of the things that has sort of, I mean, you know, in a very minor level, in a very different way than me going to see a popcorn movie, has always kind of disappointed me about these X-Men movies, is we have yet to see the world where mutants are just coexisting with humans. I mean,
that's because the story doesn't currently exist.
That'd make a pretty boring movie.
The thing is, like, the story doesn't currently, like, no one has really wrote that story.
Well, what would it look like?
I'm a writer, and if I could get in contact with Marvel, I would be happy to write that story.
But
I think it could be very interesting. When do we get to that point? I mean, it's just... the premise of these movies, every single movie, is humans don't like mutants, and Magneto realizes that and wants mutants to be their own kind and break away from that, whereas Charles Xavier is trying to marry that.
But what would I would ask you, what is the... For the sake of movies, what is the point? What is the story in that movie?
I think it's... you're going to have to unite them for some reason. Like, it's kind of like...
Trask is trying to do.
Like, no. It's kind of
I think there has to be a third threat, right?
That's what I say.
That's the classic thing. Earth will unify when the aliens come. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be, like, what's going to be the unifying thing that brings them together?
And Independence Day.
But that's the thing is like, in the Marvel Universe, that's what the Avengers are. They don't need the mutants to also be loved, because that's what the Avengers are for. That's what these people who aren't mutants, they have powers but aren't mutants, are for. So in that sense, I don't know. It's just, if you just talk about in the X-Men universe, you're never going to get that story, because if you just talk about for a Fox X-Men movie universe, that story doesn't seem to have like a lasting point for the humans.
And until
Apocalypse, the third threat, you know,
until Apocalypse comes online. That's what I was kind of wondering about Apocalypse. Is that going to be the third threat where we finally kind of have this? Because I'm just saying it, and I'm not talking.
Apocalypse is a mutant.
I'm not talking in terms of, like, you know, saying it being a compelling story necessarily. What would you need to do to make that impetus? I'm just saying that all of these movies just almost kind of lazily just rely on the, well, mutants are different than humans, and obviously humans are going to be trying to get rid of mutants. And, you know, I'm saying can we move past that, like, in the next movie or two, and get to a point where we have something write that story, is what I'm saying. That is a story. There is a story there. And I think, you know, it is a third thread. It is a unification. But, like, what happens when something goes wrong with that? You know, what happens, you know, in the turmoil of that? You know, you have a segment that is unified with humans. I mean, because I just think that it's kind of a lazy, you know, kind of story cliche to just say that all humans hate mutants and all the mutants are, you know, outcasts and different and all that stuff.
They didn't in this movie.
Yeah, they didn't say that all mutant humans.
They said
hate
even
mutants.
Sympathizers were being rounded up by this.
Right, and that's in 2023.
But I think it's a really big generalization of what the movie got to the point of. It was saying that on both sides there are extremists. On both sides there are vast extremes where people reside and people do stupid things, and that turns the broader, less extreme people against those who are just generally the mutants. Mm-hmm. You talk about that, like it isn't that the mutants were hated. It was that the mutants did something, and Mystique killed Trask, you know, in this timeline to make the mutants to prove he's right. They are terrible. To the general public, who at that point Nixon was just like, or the entire, you know, armed forces were just like, why do we need Sentinels again? Like, I don't think we need Sentinels. Like, I don't see a problem here. You know, they've been helpful in the past. I don't see a problem here. And it wasn't until the extremists on one side or the other stepped out and said, now we see a problem here. Okay, let's go ahead and build these Sentinels. So I don't think that they always do this story that's really general. I do think, though, that it, I mean, with the mutants, it tends to be, it's rare that it's mutant against mutant. It's mutant against mutant. It's usually mutant against mutant because of something that the humans are doing.
Well, the other part of it is, I think that as often as we've heard the story, we're going to continue to hear the mutant versus human story again and again, because even if there is a way that humans and mutants could live in harmony,
mm-hmm.
Whenever you think of this as like an allegory or a satire or whatever,
mm-hmm.
For, like I said, racism or, you know, different religions, you know, differences, homophobia, mm-hmm. Anything that we have going on in popular culture at any given time, in history,
mm-hmm.
if you substitute that problem for mutants, we see that historically humans always have a problem with something different, and they almost always lean towards what divides them instead of what unites them. And I think that story is going to be more relatable. You're going to see that story catch
mm-hmm.
on.
Right.
Well, because it's not about human mutant. It gets used for everything. I mean, and I think one thing that I'm not going to pretend I can critique why it seems so much more extreme in culture, but everything to me, having this conversation a lot recently about how binary everybody makes all of these, whether, you know, look at how polarized Democrat, Republican, look at how, mm-hmm. how unwilling to cross the aisle in ways that previous generations actually did break through on. And,
right.
you know, whether it was looking at, whether it's human mutant or whether it's Xavier or Eric, whether you're using it as racism, or then the different stance of King and Malcolm X, or now whether you're using it for, you know, religious extremism versus atheism, or whether everything must be polarized to this sharp degree. And it may be lazy storytelling, but it is an easy well to use to reflect whatever that current polarization is. And we're always going to keep leveraging that because,
right.
sadly, that well's never dry.
Yeah,
at least
here
on Earth.
Well, it's not, and I think I don't. I guess I don't mean to make it sound like all the movies are lazy with that. I'm just saying I think there's other potential there for different stories. But, you know, I totally agree that. You know, films are all about conflict of whatever kind, and, you know, superhero movies are conflict on the technicolor level, like good versus evil. I mean, it's very, there's a bad guy, there's good guys. But, you know, it's interesting to see the broader universe of, like, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where we have the Avengers, and, you know, humans are thankful that they're there because they saved them from this alien invasion and that kind of thing. So I think, gosh, I just really want to see all these universes melded together. Yeah. I mean, somebody pay somebody the money and let's see it.
Pay somebody.
I think money will talk one day with all that, but yeah.
Well, yeah, I was going to say Wolverine. As much as people like to keep insisting he's a loner, he's on every team. I mean, he's an Avenger too.
Yeah. Well, and that's we have two. We're now gonna have two versions of Quicksilver, and well, I guess we didn't really have Scarlet Witch in this movie, but we've got Quicksilver, two Quicksilvers, one in the Avengers and one in this movie. Mm-hmm. Now into the Fox X-Men universe, and you know he was one of the best parts.
Probably the greatest entertaining moment of this film.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a minute. I figured we have to bring that up.
Yeah.
But on the topic,
well, I got to run, guys. I will let you continue the debate.
You're done.
The time has come.
Well, James,
but thanks for having me on.
Well, since you got to go real quick, you want to plug your stuff real quick?
Plug my stuff. Yeah.
How can people follow you?
Well, I'm assembling a team of mutants in the wilderness later, and where they can find me alternately, if you're not down with that, you can go to cinemagog.com, where we have reviews and audio, video, and written content for you to check out and download, and also be doing a little bit of traveling speaking, heading down to Florida later this year and other places too, and always available for that. So if people are curious or interested in having me come and talk, whether it's a church or any institution, schools, etc. That's something I like to make time for, so feel free.
All right. Awesome. Thanks so
much.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, wait.
My wonderful wife also mentions, oh, yeah, and there's a book, Cinemagog, on Amazon.com.
Oh, just that.
Yeah, you know, I forget to mention it. Yes, I guess I wrote a book. I forget that sometimes. So if you enjoy pop culture, particularly these types of movies and cinema, and are curious about how that might correlate to monomyth in the gospel, then that book's for you.
That means not only thank you, James, for taking the time to be here right before your vacation, but thank you to your wife for keeping you in line. And for
being very, very
you.
Quiet while I'm on the phone.
Well, she I've met her. She's awesome. So
good talking to you.
Good talking to you, man.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Quicksilver and preferences over bone claws and adamantium await. Have fun.
Thanks, James. Bye.
Bye.
All right, but that's actually a good place, because we were going to move to closing it down a little bit, which means, and speaking of money, which we were right before James had to go, Wade Bearden, who has been a guest on the show, actually Twittered this question.
Tweeted.
I said that we're going to be talking about Days of Future Past tonight, and asked if anyone had any questions about the movie. And he said, besides Apocalypse and Wolverine 3, what sequels, prequels, offshoots do you think will come of Days of Future Past? I think the subtext of that is obviously we've kind of reset the universe, so everything's possible.
Yeah.
So I throw it to both of you guys. What do you think, besides another Wolverine movie, since that's a cash cow, and obviously the already announced Apocalypse, do you think we'll see anything else?
Personally, I hope, and you know, we're talking about hope here. You need me to hope again. I'm hoping.
I need
again.
You to hope again, Mark.
I hope we get an original cast movie again, because I really enjoy the original cast. I would love to see more of Jean Grey kind of, you know, explored again. Maybe. If we're talking about, you know, how they talked a little bit in this movie about, like, can you really avoid your destiny? Can you really change, you know, the whole idea of, can you change the future, or can you just delay the inevitable? Does she ultimately become Dark Phoenix no matter what? And we could, there's, you know, I read an interesting kind of explanation of, it was kind of a quick explanation, but there could be basically a Dark Phoenix movie or a Dark Phoenix trilogy. I mean, because she's really, you know, big time villain and a kind of chaotic happening that the X-Men have to deal with in the comics, and it was a great series in the cartoon, you know, that I watched growing up. So I would love to see that and kind of see more. I always want more Patrick Stewart. You always want more Patrick Stewart. And I mean, I like Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, so I hope he sticks around. But I really want some. I mean, there's all kinds of things you could offshoot to, but I would really like an original cast movie again, as much as I would love to see, of course, more first class cast. Mm-hmm. That was a little tongue twister there. But ultimately, I would love to see the Marvel Cinematic Universe meld with Fox and just...
Yeah, besides the fact that's not going to happen, I appreciate you
wanting
that, Devin.
You never know. We need you to hope again about that.
So what do you see, Griffin?
I don't think it's going to happen, Mark, so I think you're just going to be let down by that. And that's okay. So I would love to see a school book or a school movie kind of about the newer mutants, like kind of a new X-Men, Grant Morrison, his stuff whenever, you know, all these new characters were coming about. Mm-hmm. And kind of the odd... I would love to see creators outside of comics create new mutants and say, like, here's our world.
Yeah.
And really set themselves apart and set this world, this universe apart and say this is a different storyline.
What would that look like in movie form, though? I mean, like, you're talking about, like a TV show or just, like...
Sure. No, because then it turns into, like, a new mutant every week, and that's just really boring. I'm talking more like Grant Morrison's New X-Men was, like, there was a larger threat, but as they were finding the larger threat, they were meeting a whole lot of new, you know, mutants along the way. And there was kind of this spark happening where you have new mutants being created. I'd also
kinda
be
like, kind of like focusing on Charles Xavier's school.
Yeah.
I mean, just focus on the school.
On the school, yeah. Focus on what happens there.
Like, they could have an offshoot adventure with, like, all of these younger, newer mutants.
I would love to see a, kind of X-Force team, like Uncanny X-Force, which is basically, like, you have, you know, Wolverine kind of leading a hit squad team, like, you know, actual, like, murdering people.
That could be a sitcom, right?
Yeah. I always like that story because it's just, like, it's, like, the stuff that only Wolverine can deal with, mm-hmm. No one else even knows about because they can't get their hands dirty with that. But Wolverine's like, I guess I got to do the dirty work around here. Mm-hmm. And
anything that you realistically see, like, coming out of this?
A Nightcrawler movie, probably.
You think?
Yeah, I think you'll get a Nightcrawler movie.
You're going to get a Channing Tatum Gambit movie?
That's already happening. The Nightcrawler stuff, they can go back in time and do the whole swashbuckling pirate deal. And that's in comics. That's been done. So they can kind of go down that path with Nightcrawler, and people would love it.
I think you're going to see more offshoots from Apocalypse than you are from this movie. This movie doesn't really set up offshoots.
I just want X-Men Universe Nixon movie about Watergate and just what was happening.
We all want to find the movie about where JFK was really a mutant.
Let's tell that story.
Well, okay, so that moves us into our semi-closing where we say, even though we enjoyed the movie, there was something in it that made us kind of say, come on.
Mm-hmm.
So what were your come on moments, Mark?
I was when Magneto lifts up the ball stadium, the baseball stadium, and just for basically no reason other than a really cool CGI effect, because there's really no reason to it. I mean, yes, I know he sets it as like a boundary around what he wants to do at the White House, but he already has Sentinels, and then he could just, I mean, they could have done anything else to set up a bear. I just thought it was dumb. There was no point to it.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of cool, but it just was kind of like,
but why?
It really frustrated me that Pong moved faster because Quicksilver was playing it. I got so I was like, that is not how that game works. That is absolutely not how that game works. And like, it's not going to move faster because he's playing it. And then I said that to someone, they were like, well, it goes faster if you play longer. I was like, he'd only been playing a second and it was going like through a game. And I'm like,
playing it the whole time.
No, I'm sorry. It was like way sped up. It's like, what kind of difficulty setting is this? I don't understand. That was my come on moment for sure.
Well, I wrote down the stadium. I thought it looked like all kinds of cool.
It looked great, yeah.
And it just, you know, it was left me in awe of Magneto's power and what he could do. And I was just like,
there's no point to it.
Why?
Yeah.
Well, I want to know who the engineers are because that place had no foundation at all. It was just straight on dirt, just right on top of like the circle was just on top of dirt. He's just
he
all right, let's go.
He pulled it out. just at the right places.
Oh,
strategic,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Strategery.
The rebar. You just pulled,
yeah,
it together,
you pulled the rebar out. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, any other egregious come on moments?
Speaking of rebar,
speaking of rebar.
that whole Wolverine scene in the
I read that it was a nod to the comic.
It was a nod to the comic. It was also a nod to the first movies. And then you have the whole thing where so part of me is like, I don't know. Does he have adamantium claws when he shows up in the new timeline? Does he? Is it still bone claws? Is that going to be another story that they're going to tell later on?
I think anytime you see now, since Origins, anytime you see William Stryker, you get this bad taste in your mouth because of Origins, the Origins movie. And so I just think, and he was like, he was such a clunky actor, and I didn't like him at all.
That was some of it, too.
There was the young Stryker. Oh,
there was
yeah.
Terrible, terrible extras acting in this movie.
Well, because the young Stryker basically looked like it could have been Sean, somebody's brother, the guy from Role Models. Stifler,
Sean
William Scott.
It looked like Sean William Scott. Like if he had a brother, he might have had a brother. I don't know.
But still, like there was some really bad, like there's one line, like actors who get like one line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there were some bad. Like there was at least two or three that I was like, man.
Well, look,
that was garbage. Like who did they? I can do better than that.
Well, look,
like,
you had Ian McKellen. And, you know, Sir Patrick Stewart, McAvoy.
They pull some kid off the street and say, hey, here's $100, say this line.
Fassbender. all these, like, Academy Award level actors, and then you're like, well, we've only got, like, $20 left.
Yeah.
Who do we have, like, on the SAG list we can use?
People on the set would have been better. I imagine, like, the best boy would have handled that better.
Oh, man.
All right, well... Okay, so we transition from that to our favorite moments of the movie.
I thought Blink's portals and the way that they use them and like the action that kind of surrounded that was just really cool. I just thought that was...
Yeah, that moment with Colossus. I was like, that was awesome.
Like,
that was
like,
freaking
awesome.
He jumped. She put the portal down. He's flying down the ground. She puts the portal. He hits the... Oh, my gosh.
That
crazy.
Was, I mean, it's really...
Too bad it didn't
something.
Matter.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't, but that was, like, such a cool moment.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, when you had, like, those two separated storylines, and really the best action happened in the one that was not featured as much,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the beginning and kind of at the end. I mean, it's, like, the future storyline. I thought it was really inventive, and anytime you see an inventive action sequence, you're just going to kind of get your blood pumping, and you're just going to be really enthralled, and I really was. I just thought that was really cool. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff. I mean,
Don't take it.
I'm not going to take it. I don't really have anything specific. I was just going to say, in general, these movies are all very inventive and do a lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah. As much as I'm like not sure that this is how that character works, the scene with Quicksilver in the kitchen was absolutely... That was just like fun to watch. And, I was like, I don't know if that's how that works. But I'll take it, like, because that was hilarious. Like,
this whole addition of his character, someone who's, I think, from a non-comic book character, comic book reader, being like, Quick Who?
Yeah.
So is he like the Flash or something?
Well,
and then taking him and not only using him in a movie, but...
Because that's why, I mean, they had to take him out after that scene. And I think that's the best thing about this movie was, like, Bryan Singer recognized that scene was so awesome and people are going to love him so much just for that scene. We can't make him be in the rest of the movie because then he'll just be, like, everyone will expect that he'll just be the best.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he just isn't. He, you know, that's just not, I mean, he's pretty cool, but he's not like, no, nobody's like, man, I love Quicksilver.
Well, they do now.
I do love that they introduced Scarlet Witch in this movie kind of by proxy because Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, okay, this is kind of a comic thing, but there's that moment in the movie where Quicksilver says something about, they talk about, you know, this other guy, you know, Magneto.
Yeah, my mom used to be into a guy who could do that.
Yeah, and so then it's like, oh, so he's Magneto's son, all right.
Mm-hmm. Fassbender even has a look on his face for a second.
Yeah, and then so is Scarlet Witch is his daughter. But then you have that moment where Scarlet Witch is like, they're at the house and he's like sitting on the lap. And I was like, oh, this is so awesome. This is like looking into the future.
Yeah.
And so I like that Singer is setting up some of these things for, I guess, future movies. I don't know if he'll ever use Scarlet Witch, mainly just because that would be almost, it's almost like Marvel and Fox kind of taking shots at each other right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's talk of like Marvel canceling the Fantastic Four comic while Fox is in like production and is like marketing their next Fantastic Four movie, and just canceling it during that time.
Why? Why not be like, hey, you want a Fantastic Four that doesn't suck that bad?
Yeah.
Come read the comics.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, but it's one of those things. I mean, you know, Mara will be.
I'll tell
there,
you.
Right? Yeah.
Money talks.
Kate Mara will be in there, so yeah. I'll be there. I'll be in the theater.
Money talks. One day these worlds are going to come back together.
Well, that's the thing. It's my money, though, versus somebody else's money. Like, yeah. If it was just everyone got paid, then I think they'd be fine. But it's... No, you start... Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite moment, I think... my favorite sub-moment was the Quicksilver stuff, but so many people already like pointed that out.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure I had something else just in case. And so I kind of already mentioned it. It's that scene on the plane where you have... like James had mentioned earlier... You probably have the most intensely the best acted scene in the entire thing when Charles has to confront Eric for the first time since, you know, Eric, that was basically since they left the beach in Cuba, and their worldviews collide. And I thought the dialogue was great, and I thought the acting was great, and just the, I don't know, cutting to the outside of the plane and watching like Eric or Magneto get upset and it start to just buckle the plane. I just was like, this is brilliant. This is a small thing that's a really, that becomes a really big thing. So just that entire scene, I thought it gave a lot of credibility to the movie, in my opinion. So that was my favorite.
I really enjoyed a lot of the action sequences were really... They were a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, they were over quickly. You know, it was like they didn't linger too long on it and stuff like that. I thought they were really done at fast pace, and I thought Mystique's stuff was just, I don't know, it was just really cool. Yeah. You know, like, in a way that's not just like, oh, that's, she's just, you know, kicking butt. It was like, however they did it, just made it pop, you know, made it sing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, let me ask you.
Singer.
let me ask you this. I was listening to NPR today, and they were talking about this on there, and I wanted to ask your guys' opinion on it. So we're about a month into like the summer movies, and the summer movies are always such an interesting thing because we talk about them as being great movies when really they're not like comparable to like the December movies. It's kind of like,
yeah,
sure.
Eh. At what point do you feel like the summer movies have to be more? Because right now I think these, you know, Marvel and Fox and Sony kind of put things out and just know that we're going to pay for it. They know we're going to go see it. They know we're going to spend the buck. Spider-Man's one of those things where it feels like, and I know that they're like a different opinions, but I mean, it feels like they're just kind of phoning it in and putting out a Spider-Man movie to just make some money. And I don't feel like X-Men's this way at all. I feel like X-Men, they really, I mean, they hired Bryan Singer, and I don't think people realize like the depth to which that's a great get for movies, for this kind of, you know, superhero movie. But at what point do you feel like that changes, or does that ever change? You know, that they're just phoning it in for...
It'll never change.
You don't think it'll ever change?
Because people will not stop paying for it.
Well, I'm going to say, it'll only change if about the almighty dollar it goes somewhere else.
Yeah.
Now, that's the thing. As long as studios are fine with their, you know, $150 million movie only making $200 million, then this will never stop. Now, you know, I'm sure $50 million is... It's like an infinity money to us, because we can't even fathom that.
Right.
But to them, that might not be enough room to risk.
Yeah, it's a profit margin.
But I think that's also... I mean, we obviously don't know where Days of Future Past is going to stop on the money meter.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, we just saw... what Marvel's doing now. Marvel's not putting out, in general, crappy movies.
Right.
Like, Captain America was great, and Captain America made tons of money.
Well, that's something where, like, you have something where the Avengers funds their next four movies in and of itself. Like,
And then, according to kind of, like, the vein that you're speaking in, they could just phone in those four movies, but they don't.
But they don't.
No, they put the money behind
it.
They
take them very seriously. Yeah. And I think that's also, you know, the pride of the, you know, the, it's Marvel. It's their stuff.
It's,
they want to take
Marvel,
good care of it.
It's Marvel Studios, and it is the pride of, like, it is, it's those kids who grew up and they, like, they probably grew up, a lot of them probably grew up loving comics, mm-hmm. and they're finally getting, like, they're getting a chance to put comics in the movies on the silver screen like they never had it before. Like, they got, you know, Lou Ferrigno for their comic movies, yeah. and, you know, and that's just, they're getting a chance to really make it something special, yeah. for the future. There's something about that. I mean, whenever I talk to some of these guys, and it's not, definitely not all, but a lot, some of these guys, like, have very much have the high opinion of, like, we make comics so that kids will realize that they don't just, that they can learn to read at reading something other than just novels, mm-hmm. if they don't like novels. And we support the movies because we hope that that'll lead the kids back to the comics so that they'll learn, they'll once again lead them back to reading. As such, one of the, like, the most interesting aspects of comics, and that I think that just so many people miss, that's the goal for a lot of these people. I mean, I know so many creators who love kids, but mm-hmm. without, like, just love having kids around because it's like, hey, you're reading stuff. This is awesome. Like, you normally hate to read.
Yeah,
I hate
it's kind of like you answer your own question. I don't mean that in a funny way. I mean, it's like, you know, when people want to care about making a good movie, that's when that line will start to, you know, separate itself from the ones that are just phoned in. And a lot of it, as far as a filmmaking standpoint, they don't set out to make a crappy movie. There's decisions made and twists along the production line. I mean, it's like, how good would Edgar Wright's Ant-Man be? We'll never know because somebody...
No, we know. It would have been amazing.
We'll still kind of find out because they're not reshooting that movie. The editing will look different, yes, but they're not. I mean, they're not reshooting that movie. They're way too deep into it now.
They haven't shot it.
They had to have already started.
Nope.
No, they've been.
They haven't started.
They changed
anything?
The script, doing... and he left.
Oh,
yeah.
They hadn't shot it.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
he's been working on the story for, like, years
since 2006. He got 2006. He's been talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really think, you know, like, I don't think Mark Webb sat down with the writers of Amazing Spider-Man 2 and said, you know what, let's make a phone-in movie so we can just make this and make a lot of money. I think he sets out to make a good movie, but people are like, with studios, like, we need to set up the Sinister Six movie, and we need to set up our own universe here. We need a big, and you just get... You have to make decisions to meet everybody's standards because it's a whole lot of money.
But even beyond comics, like, I mean, talk about Transcendent. I mean, that movie is... Or Transcendence. I mean, that is like... It's a big-budget film that... just ends up
right,
being
just,
I mean, and it's like, you know, you talk about, I mean, there have been a lot of talk of the Wachowskis and what they're going to do next, or the Wachowskis, or however you say it, you know, what they're going to do next. I mean, it's just like, they put out these huge budget films because they know during the summer people are going to pay to go see it,
right.
But it's not,
well, it's, I just think, you know, I mean, I don't think anybody actually ever starts out saying, let's make a phone-in movie. I think people, they make a lot of,
you know how, I don't like people using absolutes.
Uh-huh.
So just be careful using absolutes because there's always Michael Bay.
Well, that's true.
There's always George Lucas.
Yeah.
There's
always the example.
Yeah, okay. All right. So I'm not going to use an absolute.
If Transformers 2 was not a phone-in movie.
Yeah.
Then
clearly.
If the new Indiana, if the King of the Crystal Skull was not George Lucas being like, hey, you know what? I hate my fans.
That wasn't a phone in, so he had to go out of his way to hate.
But I did want to point out one thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
So we, you know, we close out because we could talk about this all night. It's been another podcast. But I do think that, like, you know, you're talking about, like, the summer movies versus the December movies. Well, you think about the biggest budget fantasy movie that won an Academy Award for Best Picture was Return of the King, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. And I would say, now, I love Return of the King. I think the first movie is probably the best film out of them. But I would say that The Avengers is better than Return of the King. And now that's an argument you could probably, you know, take several hours to try to make or whatever. But if the Return of the King won Best Picture at the Academy Awards, I think The Avengers is good enough to do that.
Well, I think... I did this on the site. Every year I give my top 10 films, and The Avengers, the year it came out, was my favorite film of all year. I thought it was the best, you know, 5 stars, whatever, however you want to rank it, A+, plus, you know.
Plus.
110 points because you got 10 points of extra credit.
Right.
You know, whatever. And I think that's a conversation that we probably could have talked about at great length for the Oscars, and we did to some degree mention that. If you are listening to the show now and you didn't listen to our one on American Hustle, where we also kind of talked about the Oscars a little bit, mm-hmm. and how that works, we were kind of sad that, you know, just because you're a blockbuster movie,
yeah.
Well, the only thing that you know you have a chance to win is for, like, score or, you know, cinematography, like, or effects.
That's, like, the funniest thing about it is, like, and it's also, you're only an Oscar movie if you came out in the month leading up to the Oscars. You know,
it's usually all year.
You guys realize what I'm saying, that the Best Picture nominees, name one of them that wasn't released in November or December.
Or later, yeah.
You know, I'm going to homer this one like nobody's business, but Wes Anderson has put out films year-round and never gotten nominated for anything.
Right.
You know,
well, he's nominated for things. It's always screenplay, though.
But my thing is that there are plenty of great writers and directors that don't. Edgar Wright's movies, you know, hilarious. Mm-hmm. Hot Fuzz should have won Best Comedy definitely the year that it came out, at least at the Golden Globes. So it's like one of those things where because it doesn't come out in like the month or two leading up to, they don't really give it a.
And you gotta, I mean, you gotta. It's a hard argument to make too, because there's a whole campaign behind all those movies.
Oh, I mean, I realize because they send out,
you have to pay,
they send out
for your consideration ads and all that stuff. And so,
well, let's put it this way: is there any chance that Days of Future Past gets nominated for an Oscar?
No,
for any category.
No, they will not. They will not.
I can see effects. I mean, like, you know, sound editing. I don't know much about it, all that stuff, but I mean, it's a well done movie. I mean, you know, it's really well done. But that's about all that those movies, like you said, all they ever get.
I mean, we're taking like. I mean,
you're not going
to
get.
Can we fly to Vegas and put bets on whether? I mean, I'm sure that somewhere in Vegas they will take bet.
They do, but sure. We're not going to see McAvoy for. No. You know, they're going to put a picture of him up there for supporting acting. We're going to get a clip of him going, "I don't want your future."
Yeah,
we're not going to get that.
Don't want your future.
I don't want your life. Yeah. I, that's what I wanted him to say to Xavier, because no one here is old. Wait, we're all old enough to have seen Varsity Blues. Right?
Also, yeah,
no.
You know that scene in Days of Future Past where Magneto hops on the train, and literally the tracks are just like coming mm-hmm. off. Like that's where we are right now. We're off the
train. Okay.
The rails. So, the rails are
off the rails. Right. The rails are right. Turning into.
It's not. The train's not falling off the rails. The train's not falling off the rails. The train's falling off onto the rocks because there are no rails left.
That's right.
Well, final thoughts on Days of Future Past.
You know, as much as I thought about this movie leading up to this podcast, the only thing I could think of were all of the flaws I found with it. If you really think about this movie, there's a lot of flaws with it as far as, like, you know, I mean, filmmaking stuff, but storyline stuff, I mean, stuff that just, they just kind of glossed over.
We spent a long time talking about how that was cool.
Right, but, you know, and right, not necessarily the glossing over, like, we don't need to explain this, but the glossing over of, like, this just works, and this is just a thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was surprised that I was focusing on that, but when I came out of the movie, I was like, oh my gosh, that was awesome, you know? Whereas if I did that with, like, Avengers, I wouldn't find any flaws.
So you would highly recommend someone going and seeing it? Just don't think about it later.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, go into it. If you like X-Men, especially if you've seen all the movies and you've been... you know, following them all along and been a big fan, you've probably already seen it. But if you have, I mean, go see it again. I think it's worth seeing again. I would love to see it again. So,
Mr. Kale.
Final thoughts. I liked it. I liked it a lot. I still like Winter Soldier better.
That's right.
I still think it was a better movie this year.
Winter Soldier is a better movie.
I think that Bryan Singer going in at the end and like retconning everything kind of frustrated me a little bit. And, you know, a lot of people have asked, well, what about this? Could this still have worked? I'm like, well, it's so vague
mm-hmm.
that it's likely he just said, let's just go ahead and wipe all this stuff out and go into a completely different universe. And I just, part of me is like, well, why did you make those first two movies? You know, what was the point of that?
The argument would be he made those first two movies because he wanted to set up for something later that he didn't do. And so he had to fix what happened in the third one. Yeah.
But no, but it felt like he retconned two, didn't he? Because Cyclops is at the end of two dead.
Well, yeah, but you can't retcon three without retconning the
Cyclops
first two.
Cyclops is, well, yeah, he did, well, he did retcon to technically.
And you don't
well,
that,
only the Jean stuff.
You
she dies at the end of 2.
You don't even know that Jean is Phoenix right now. I mean, she may be. Her hair is a little bit more red than normal.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, there's so, a...
We know.
There's a lot of... There's a, and that, that scene is so... And that was one of the things. Like, that scene is so quick. And he just kind of... You see people. I mean, you see Beast. You see Jean. You see Cyclops. And there's some funny stuff and cool and everything.
The Apocalypse setup was pretty sweet, though. I feel like they did that so well. And they... For fans, it's was almost impossible for me to tell it was Apocalypse until I saw the bare glimpse of the Four Horsemen,
Yeah.
in the back. I mean, and like the only reason I knew that it was there was because I had read that there was a ending to the movie, and like I was like, okay, what's going to be the ending? Because I'm either going to stay or I'm not. I'm not going to do the thing I did with Spider-Man where I stay and then it's just X-Men trailer. Whatever sense that made. But yeah, so like I was like, oh, they're horse in the background. I wouldn't have noticed it had I not read that before, because I mean, it was like half a second.
Yeah.
And it was like,
yeah.
And cut.
I know zero about all that whole Apocalypse stuff, so it was a cool scene, but I really don't know what it was setting up. So,
well, I'll say... To close out, that I also really enjoyed the film, like we talked about. Mm-hmm. It was my favorite X-Men film.
Yeah.
But, kind of like Griffin said, or was hinting at...
Wait. Your favorite X-Men film of all the X-Men films? This one?
Yes.
Cool.
I mean, like, I would say First Class is right behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But then...
Yeah, I didn't enjoy Wolverine like you enjoyed Wolverine.
Right.
And that was just...
Well, Wolverine's not my favorite X-Men movie.
No, I didn't really... Whatever people want to say, kind of like James was kind of throwing it out there earlier saying, like, I don't kind of care. I didn't think X3, The Last Stand, was that bad.
Yeah.
I didn't think any of the first X-Men movies were all that great. I was like, okay, mm-hmm. well, this movie. Like, none of them, like,
mm-hmm.
comic book movie-wise would be in my top five, I guess.
But they're no Green Lantern. I mean, they're not that bad.
Yeah, they're not that bad.
Whoa.
They're not Green Lantern bad. They're not Daredevil bad.
I mean, they're not even... And I kind of like this movie, so I'm not going to... They're not even Punisher bad. You know?
Yeah. Well, which Punisher?
First one.
Wait.
Thomas Jane.
Yeah, I mean, say, you mean, yeah. You mean Dolph Travolta. Lundgren Punisher?
No, not Dolph Lundgren.
No, you mean John Travolta, Thomas Jane.
Yeah. So, But yeah, I mean, I just thought there were okay movies about superheroes,
mm-hmm.
which kind of leads me to one of my comparisons here. Like, even though this was my favorite X-Men film, it still felt kind of like an X-Men film where things are sort of silly. Like, the powers are a little too flamboyant, like, things are just a little too over the top,
okay.
Whereas... In the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I feel like I don't get that. And I know, like I said, I'm not using absolutes because I know there are times in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Like Thor?
Like, well, but then you're...
Like Asgard with lasers?
Asgard,
out of the,
like I said, this is a different... It's a different kind of thing,
yeah,
because you're basically,
I mean,
you're saying this is a crazy thing, and then
right.
you're filming the crazy thing.
Yeah, you're saying this is gods, and it's crazy.
Yeah.
You're saying here, this is mutated humans.
Yeah, X-Men, you're like, you're saying this is happening in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of like, well, this is kind of sillily happening in the 60s.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, Captain America is not silly, it's
right.
over the top,
right.
it's intense. You know, it's obviously a little bit unbelievable, but it's like, hey, maybe this is happening in this time.
So you don't think the X-Men take it as like Captain America would take it as like, what if this actually happened in real life?
Yeah. I mean, they say it happens in X-Men saying it's happening in real life,
right.
but it doesn't look like it's happening in real life.
Right.
And once again, like I said, I know where that's a very blurry line.
I don't want to
get in a fight with anybody over that. But because of that, I still prefer almost everything in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Conceptually to the X-Men movies, though, you know, there are, you know, the Iron Man 2, I would watch Days of Future Past before I watch Iron Man 3 again.
Hmm.
You know, Thor, the original Thor movie, it was good-ish.
Line them all up, I'll watch them back to back. Single movie.
But yeah, I mean, I like them all. I mean, we're talking about a level of degree.
Yeah.
So with that said, as the umbrella statement. So
okay.
We close.
Yeah.
And when we close, I thank James Harleman, who, if you're listening, has obviously had to leave. We stopped him from going on vacation. Thanks so much for being here. But also joined by Griffin Kale, Mark Wingard, the two gentlemen that were on the podcast 1 year ago today when we launched Real World Theology. So I'm so thankful that they're still here, still talking about movies, talking about theology.
Yeah, I've been meaning to talk to you about that.
It's still putting up with me. So
this is my last show. I really appreciate it all.
Yeah. Well, just kidding. I really appreciate you. I really appreciate you listeners who have been with us for the entire year, people who picked us up and who've gone back and listened to episodes of your favorite movies that you'd seen before you actually found the podcast. And it's been a real pleasure to be doing this for a year, something that I thought, well, I'll try this, see if I can stick with an episode or two.
Yeah.
I think originally I'd planned to do maybe one episode a month, now I'm at two. And I wanted to announce now that we've made it a year, and because it's summertime, I know lots of people have wanted us to do more shows. I'm going to do three a month for June, July, and August for the summer movies. So those of you who have enjoyed the show and want a little bit more for the next 3 months, I'm going to do everything I can to get three shows out during those months. Cool. So that's, if you like the show, hopefully that's a reward, not a punishment.
Don't forget the live events.
Yeah, and then we have lots of live events that we're doing where we're going to watch a movie and talk about it. So if you go to Real World Theology, you can see that. But I want to give my guests, like I said, the guys who've been there from the beginning, a chance to plug anything that they have, let you know how they can get a hold of them. So, Griffin, how can people follow you?
Twitter, Griffin_Kale. It's GRIFFIN_KALE, like the plant that the hipsters like. Instagram, I think Instagram may be the same thing, but disregard that. Facebook, all that stuff. I have a website that I haven't updated in a while, to which I will say that the next update will explain why I haven't updated in a while.
What's that website called?
GriffinKale.com.
What?
Pretty simple there. pretty self-explanatory there where that's at. And yeah, you can get a hold of me at those places. I have like very little internet presence at the current moment. Like, mm-hmm. I just don't update anything.
So keep listening to Real World Theology.
Yeah, just keep, I mean, literally, this is the most I've done in like the last 2 months on the internet. So you can occasionally, I mean, if you follow the right people and follow me, you'll get to see some funny conversations on Twitter.
We're on the internet right now. This is the internet. Oh my gosh! I always wonder what it looked like.
Yeah, yeah. You see that secret of the internet place. It's a little black box.
Yeah. But yeah, if you follow the right people, you'll get a lot more enjoyment out of my Twitter than if you just read what I say. just blanket, you know, my statements, but.
Yes. I have a lot of kind of projects on the burner right now. A lot of things kind of left plates spinning. But you can always follow me on Twitter as well. Griffin is spinning imaginary plates for me. Thank you for keeping those up. My Twitter handle, I guess, is Mark Wingdinger. I'm also trying to do things on Real World. I do have a couple of things that I've been meaning to put out there. I apologize for that. Getting there, though.
You're letting the fans down, Mark.
Yeah.
Not me.
But again,
as
I always say, I'm a writer, so I do a lot of things that nobody knows about. But maybe you will one day, after I've made a lot of money and sold it to a studio. But that's me.
Well, all that stuff, including how to get a hold of James Harleman, get his book on Amazon, I'll have all that in the show notes. You can find that. This episode at realworldtheology.com. If you want to keep this discussion going or just post follow-up questions, please follow at realworldtheo on Twitter.
Theo
is the guy who's in charge of everything.
Oh, gotcha. The man.
Theo keeps it real in this world.
He's from the Cosby Show. You can connect with the show on Facebook. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. If you enjoy it, review the show. Leave us some feedback. We love all your 5-star reviews. I will shamelessly plug your review if you give us a 5-star review on the show. So please do that. Again, I want to thank my guests for being here. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
And thank you to listeners for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless.
It's not.
Happy 1-year anniversary.
Happy 1 year.
It is our 1-year anniversary. That's awesome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.